Welcome to the Hardwell Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. On this week's episode, we'll recap the winter meetings, we'll discuss the Orioles' managerial hire, and we'll talk about the newest members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. We'll have some more fun with Christmas-themed names, and we'll conclude with another edition of This Week in Baseball History. The winter meetings have come and gone. Here's a quick rundown of some of the biggest moves. In what will forever be known as a Jerry DePoto hospital bed trade, Seattle, Cleveland, and Tampa Bay made a three-way swap which sent Edwin Encarnacion and a comp pick to the Mariners, Carlos Santana and Jake Bowers to Cleveland, and Yandy Diaz plus a minor leaguer going to the Rays. And in case you didn't hear, DePoto got this deal done while in the hospital for blood clots in his lungs. We wish him a speedy recovery.
One of the big free agent outfielders is officially off the board, as Andrew McCutchen thankfully has left the Yankees behind to sign a three-year $50 million deal with the Phillies.
The Dodgers continue a long tradition of acquiring pitchers hated by their fan base as they inked Joe Kelly to a three-year $25 million contract.
There was some movement on the starting pitching market as Lance Lynn signed with the Rangers for 3 years and $30 million, while Charlie Morton signed with the Rays for 2 years and $30 million.
It wasn't a signing or a trade, but Troy Tulowitzki was released from the Blue Jays with 2 years, plus a team option for 2021, remaining on his contract.
So, which of these moves will have the biggest impacts on baseball next season?
I want to say, just in terms of capabilities and name alone, of this list, as far as individual players go, I would say Andrew McCutchen with the Phillies. I think that's a really good signing for them, and he should be able to contribute quite a bit to the team and help them be more competitive this season than they were this past season.
Yeah, I'm with Mary on this one. I think we were kind of on the money last week when we said that there wouldn't be too much in the way of big moves happening at the winter meetings. You know, still have Harper and Machado on the board. And as expected, there were kind of these smaller scale things, but nothing that's going to be like earth shattering when it comes to changing the landscape of the game next year.
I will say I feel quite sorry for Jake Bowers, just in terms of his physical proximity to Trevor Bauer now, and just the mix-ups that I foresee happening with the similarities in their last names. So I hope that he does not suffer too much in this move.
Yeah, it's going to be really confusing. They have Bauer, they have Bowers. I don't know much about Jake Bowers as a person, but I can assume he's probably a better person than Trevor Bauer and probably doesn't deserve that sort of mix-up to happen to him.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate for Jake Bowers because Trevor Bauer exists, and hopefully he can navigate through all of this okay. But yeah, I agree. You know, there were no like real earth-stopping, oh my God, this deal actually happened trades. I think the biggest one is the McCutchen deal, which is really good for the Phillies. I think that is a deal that they needed to bolster their outfield no matter what, and I think they got a really good deal with McCutchen, and McCutchen got a good cut of it too. Like, that's a pretty good deal for a player, especially one who's kind of older in the outfield than like he is. But he brings a lot to the plate, and he's absolutely worth all that money. But otherwise, that's probably going to be the biggest impact on baseball, like, out of these set of moves.
Yeah, and in terms of most confusing, it would have to go to this three-way trade. Like, I just can't figure out how these moves factor into any of the three teams in terms of what they have done so far this offseason. Like, it just seems very confusing all around for me.
It seems like a lot of maneuvering on Jerry DePoto's part for a comp pick.
Yeah.
DePoto.
And it seems very weird to me that the Rays would give up Jake Bowers because he was going to be their first base guy. And I think they put a lot of hopes on him. He was, I think, one of their bigger minor league names that they thought would be able to contribute at the major leagues. And obviously they would have paid him league minimum. So that just seems like a weird time to get rid of him.
On the subject of the Rays, I'll mention the Charlie Morton deal bumped, like, nearly doubled what their opening day payroll is going to be right now, which is, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just never expect the Rays to spend any money at this point. So that trade, I mean, not trade, but that signing was just mind-boggling that more on the front that they spent $30 million. So of the many rumors that came up this week, which, if any, do we think might come to pass?
I don't think that the rumor three-way trade between the Yankees, Mets, and Marlins is going to happen. It was going to be Syndergaard going to the Yankees and Real Muto going to the Mets. Just, it all seemed like stuff that I'm sure there were conversations happening. I believe that, but I just, it everything seems to have stalled on that front, and I don't see that actually happening. It would be, as people have pointed out, yeah, a trade between the Yankees and Mets would be really unusual and would certainly be BVW making another statement that he's doing things differently. But I'm not sure this is the move that we'll see happen.
Yeah, I agree with that. That seems very unlikely. And in terms of likely things in relation to some of the bigger names, I think it's pretty likely that the Phillies will go hard after either one or both of Harper and Machado, and I could see them signing Machado.
But yeah, the White Sox traded for Machado's brother-in-law, so
that's true.
So he's clearly going to be on the White Sox next year, because that's how this works.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I agree, Mary. That's where I was thinking, because very clearly with the McCutcheon deal, it's that the Phillies are going to spend the money. They're going to bump up payroll, and they're going to go hard after either Harper or Machado. I don't think they'll get both, but I can definitely see Machado as more of a possibility, mostly considering that it's where they can fill a spot as opposed to signing another outfielder, though that would bolster their outfield to an extreme level, and wow, that would be a really good outfield. But I just think realistically that it's probably going to be Machado.
Well, in terms of other signing news, the Orioles finally have a new manager. On Friday, the club announced the hiring of Brandon Hyde, a former bench coach for the Cubs. Hyde has considerable minor league managing experience and is described by MLB.com's Joe Treasure as, quote, a strong communicator with a willingness to incorporate analytics into in-game decision making. So what do we think Hyde will bring to Baltimore?
Orioles magic?
Yeah. Oh, yes. He is a Joe Madden acolyte, so that can go any number of ways. We saw that, you know, Dave Martinez in Washington, that didn't necessarily help him that much in his first season. And that was with a pretty talented roster. In Hyde's case, it's the Orioles. They are not in good shape for next year. And I don't know exactly when they're going to be contenders again, because it's not like they have a really amazing farm system or anything with a bunch of guys who are ready to come up. I think they have like one guy in the top 100 on a MLB pipeline. And it's hard for me to see anyone being able to do anything with the team they have next year. And, you know, unless some big, huge changes are made in the next few seasons, it strikes me as being a while before we even think of the Orioles as all that relevant again. So, you know, I wish Brandon Hyde the best, but it is a tall task that he has ahead of him.
I feel like the expectations have to be low with Hyde, not only because he was a bench coach under Joe Maddon, but because this is the Orioles. Realistically, they're the Orioles. If anything, people just need to hope that Brandon Hyde can keep it together and make sure that they actually win a game next season. But the expectations have to be low, especially since I don't think that their window opens for another, like, 4 years. So, like, 2022, 2023. Yeah, it's just not looking good for the Orioles. So, Hyde just needs to make sure that the rebuild goes smoothly on the field.
Yeah, I agree with that. I hope he doesn't bring too much of the quirky Joe Maddon stuff with him, because it was just such a relief for everyone aside from the Rays in the AL East when Maddon finally left the division. So I think that would be quite annoying for a number of AL East fans, including Orioles fans, if that were to be the case. I think it'll be interesting to see how he does in this position. He's obviously on the younger side of things, although I think most people are on the younger side of Buck Showalter in baseball, so that's not saying much. But I think it's a good move for the Orioles to make to bring in somebody who apparently is good at incorporating analytics and being more on that side of things than a traditional stalwart. It'll be interesting to see what he does with a team that will not be good, as opposed to being in Chicago with a team that has been in contention for the past few years. So I don't know how much of a change that will be and what he is able to cope with in that respect. But it seems like this signing is more of a stopgap for Baltimore to just bring in somebody to kind of manage the first couple of seasons for the rebuild, and then bring in somebody else and have Hyde go somewhere to maybe a more successful team. So it just seems like somebody who's going to be there for, you know, maybe two, three seasons to just kind of get the club through this rebuild and kind of work with some of the younger players that they're going to bring in.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I didn't think of it as something that'll be like as long as Buck Showalter was with the Orioles. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think, Mary, you're spot on with that. He's just going to be there to help kind of right the ship, but he'll probably move on to bigger and better things.
Yeah. This could certainly be more of an audition than, you know, some sort of attempt to hang around Baltimore long term. So, well, we will certainly see what Brandon Hyde can do with what he's being given. Changing gears, we have a couple of new entrants to the Hall of Fame. The Today's Game era voted to induct closer Lee Smith and right fielder Harold Baines to Cooperstown. Smith pitched for 18 seasons and 8 different teams, most notably the Cubs and the Cardinals. He had a career ERA of 3.03 and a career ERA plus of 1.32. He was a 7-time All-Star and a 3-time Rolaids Relief Man of the Year. Smith also has a career BWAR of 29 and a 7-year peak of 20.9. For reference, the average 7-year peak WAR for a Hall of Fame reliever is 25.7. Then there is Baines, who played for 22 seasons, including 14 with the White Sox, hitting 384 home runs and posting a career 289 average and 820 OPS with a career 121 OPS plus. He was a 6-time All-Star. Baines' election in particular has drawn a considerable amount of backlash online, with detractors claiming that his career, though certainly above average, is not Hall-worthy. What do we think, though? Do we think that Smith and Baines are worthy of Hall inclusion?
They are certainly, especially in recent years, some of the weaker players to get into the Hall of Fame. I think kind of looking at their careers and looking at their peaks, Lee Smith has more of a case to be in the Hall of Fame than Baines, especially when there are so few relievers. So even comparing him to the current relievers in there, it doesn't really demonstrate that much, although he is, of course, as you pointed out, kind of a worse player than the relievers that are currently in the Hall. But of course, this kind of brings up the question of what the purpose of the Hall of Fame is. And it seems like the Veterans Committee just kind of looked at both of these players and were like, oh, you know, they were decent dudes. They played for a really long time. And they each had a couple of quite good seasons. So we'll put them in the Hall of Fame. And I don't know that I am that outraged by any of them, because it seems like the Hall of Fame in general, as much as it still means to the players who do get inducted into the Hall of Fame, has lost a lot of its clout in recent years. And we're kind of going through this period of understanding what it was in the past and how much of that has changed, and how we now need to view the Hall of Fame. So I'm not that bothered.
Yeah, I think that Smith was a little bit, had a stronger case than Baines, but like Mary said, I'm not really that bothered by it, because this is the Hall of Fame and I feel like they're just going to keep doing what they're doing, while a larger conversation goes on about what the Hall of Fame is supposed to be. So I guess that Smith, at the very least, is worthy of Hall induction. Baines is a little questionable, but it's going to be what it's going to be.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing where if I had a vote, I wouldn't have voted for either of these guys, but I know that it also doesn't really make a difference to me. So I'm like, yeah, good for them. Hope they can enjoy it. I feel kind of bad for Harold Baines, because, you know, dude was just sitting at home minding his own business, and it's like, oh, now everyone is scrutinizing my career. That's fun. And hopefully he's, you know, staying off the internet, not looking too much into that, and just I hope he's just able to enjoy it. But it's too bad, because he's kind of become a measuring stick for people's particular pet Hall of Fame cases. Like, oh, Harold Baines had a career 38.7 war. Here's my guy who had a career whatever war. And it's like, well, yeah, a lot of people had a higher war than he did. And I mean, I guess that's the point that we're trying to get at here, that, you know, what does it mean to be a Hall of Famer? What, you know, how much do our calculations of value in across the course of a career play into that? I don't know. It's not that big of a deal either way. I think Baines certainly got lucky in that he had a lot of friends on the committee, and that I think goes as far as anything with the today's era committee, because, you know, it's people who played with or watched play as writers, the guys who are on the ballot. And it's like Mary said, it's as much about like, oh yeah, this is a good guy and he played well and I saw him play, as much as it is the actual numbers. Yeah, it's they probably are not Hall of Famers in most people's eyes, but they are Hall of Famers in the eyes of the people who had votes, and that's just how the Hall of Fame works.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I understand where people are coming from, but I'm not really on board with the comparisons people are making between Baines' career and the current players on the ballot, and saying, oh, you know, how like 15 or 20 of these players on the ballot are better than Baines, and so like that's not fair, because it's two different methods of election. So I don't know that you can compare those, because the players on the ballot could later get in by the today's game ballot or whatever it's called. So I'm not on board with all of that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Also, for me, in a very selfish note, if there are, you know, very good players, but not really like Hall of Fame, like, oh my God, he has to be in the Hall of Fame level players, they get in through the today's game era ballot, then that means I'm just going to keep campaigning for Tim Lincecum to get into the Hall of Fame one way or another. So thank you, Lee Smith and Harold Baines. So this is our final episode of 2018, which means it's the last episode we'll be recording before Christmas, and we're going to take this opportunity to go over some of our favorite Christmas-related player names. This time, we'll focus on Santa's reindeer, starting with the most famous of them all.
And I think the best of the reindeers as well are those who have Rudolph in their name, beginning with Dick Rudolph, who pitched for the Giants and the Braves over his 13-year career beginning in 1910. He managed a 2.66 ERA in 2,049 innings, with his best season coming in 1914 when he won the World Series and finished 7th in MVP voting.
Then we have Don Rudolph, also a pitcher, who spent 6 seasons in the majors from 1957 to 1959 and then 62 to 64. He threw 450 innings of 4 ERA baseball for an ERA plus of 97.
Then there's catcher Ken Rudolph, who played for 9 seasons from 69 to 77, predominantly with the Cubs. He appeared in 328 games, hitting .213 for a career of 47 OPS plus.
And Rudolph would not be complete without the rest of his reindeer gang, so we'll move on to those names, beginning with Minnie, the Cuban Comet Minoso, if we can stretch it that far. He played a staggering 17 years between 1949 and 1980. He was a 9-time All-Star and finished 4th in MVP voting 4 times, unseating all of the Rudolphs for the most famous baseball reindeer.
Then we have second baseman Cupid Childs, who played for 13 seasons from 1888 to 1901, mainly for the Cleveland Spiders. He hit .306 in 5,622 at-bats, collecting 999 walks and compiling a 119 OPS plus.
Pitcher Joe Blitzen, Benz, played his entire 9-year career for the White Sox, entered the league in 1911. His 2.43 ERA over 1,359.1 innings is good for a 120 ERA plus.
And finally, we'll finish out the reindeer names with Dasher Troy, who was a second baseman and shortstop from 1881 to 1885. He played in 292 games, hitting .243 to match Benz's ERA.
Wow, how about that?
I know, what a pair.
As a bonus, we will throw in a Kwanzaa-related name, because we are inclusive on this podcast. We have Imani Abdullah, who is a Dodgers pitching prospect who was signed in 2015. For those who don't know, Imani is one of the 7 principles of Kwanzaa, and it means faith.
That's so what awesome. I'm getting from this is we need more Kwanzaa-related baseball players, and we need to fill out the rest of the reindeer. So that's a project for teams if they want to pick it up.
I'm sure it'll be a top priority.
I would imagine it would kind of dictate the rest of the off-season signings for these teams.
So moving on to this week in baseball history. We're defining week broadly here and including notable events from now until the end of December, since we won't be recording again until January. December 25th, 1862, throwing it way back there, 2 teams of the imprisoned Union Army soldiers play baseball at Hilton Head, South Carolina. The size of the crowd is the subject of debate by Civil War historians, but it's estimated to be somewhere around 40,000.
I think any baseball team would be happy to draw 40,000 today.
Oh, some teams would be over the moon with it.
And I especially think would... like 40,000 on Christmas Day.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I didn't. Yeah. Yeah. That's Christmas Day. Wow. Well, we are going to fast forward a number of decades to December 26th, 1934, which is known as Boxing Day in Canada. Japan's first professional baseball team, the Yomiuri Giants, is formed. League play would begin 2 years later.
Moving into the 60s, on December 22nd, 1962, Harris County voters approve a bond issue to complete the financing of an all-weather stadium to house the Houston Colt 45s. This would, of course, be known as the Astrodome when the team eventually became the Astros, and it would open in 1965.
And now for some of the most tragic news in baseball history. December 31st, 1972. Tragically, Roberto Clemente died in a plane crash en route to Nicaragua to help earthquake victims.
I think MLB, I know they have Roberto Clemente Day, but they need to do more to honor him, I think.
Yeah, there's...
I agree.
There's basically no figure in baseball history who has the sort of spotless... image he has, both in terms of his ability as a player and just his all-out goodness as a human being.
We don't deserve Roberto Clemente as a player or as a figure, and he was way too good for this world.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully one day, you know, society as a whole and Major League Baseball in particular will earn the right to promote his name as one of their own. Well, closing out this segment, we have December 23rd, 1975. Arbitrator Peter Seitz announces a landmark decision in favor of the Players Association, making pitchers Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally MLB's first official free agents, although McNally never ended up playing again. Messersmith, however, would end up signing a three-year, $1 million contract with the Braves. And we have Curt Flood to thank for both of those.
Thank you, Curt Flood. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. You can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week. Be sure to tune in for next year for the new episode. Wow. Next year, you guys. We'll see you then.